Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we're monitoring the big health bipartisan summit today in Washington. We'll be talking about it in depth in a little while with The Atlantic's James Fallows. But I want to play a clip from President Obama's introduction to the summit a short time ago. And here he is.
My hope in the several hours that we're going to be here today, that in each section that we're going to discuss, how do we lower costs for families and small businesses? How do we make sure that the insurance market works for people? How do we make sure that we are dealing with the long-term deficits? How do we make sure that people who don't have coverage can get coverage? In each of these areas, what I'm going to do is I'm going to start off by saying, here's some things we agree on.
President Obama, a short time ago, we will be closely covering that summit today. We'll have James Fallows in to talk about it in a little while. But first, our February series on life and politics in the New York area suburbs concludes right now. Larry Levy, Executive Director of the National Center for Suburban Studies at Hofstra University, is back with us for the final installment of the series. And today's topic, the city versus the suburbs, true or false?
I am, I guess, a third-generation suburbanite, and yet I always identify as a New Yorker. I think that there's a false polarity between suburbanites and New York City people.
That was Catherine from Babylon, our very first caller to this series 3 weeks ago. But instead of working together for the benefit of the whole region, the suburbs are often pitted against the city for funding. So let's talk about the power dynamics and what opportunities there are for cities and suburbs to collaborate in our area. And we want to hear from you. Do you feel competition between urban and suburban in the New York area? How does the rivalry, if there is a rivalry, play out where you live? Or do you feel more like Catherine from Babylon does? Or do you have an example of where the city and the suburbs have collaborated to make something good happen? Give us a call, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. We are public radio for the entire New York metro region, which is one of the reasons that we're doing this series looking a lot at city-suburban cooperation. You can post a comment online at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. And Larry Levy, welcome back to the show for this last time.
Well, thanks for having me back.
Now, you are on an advisory committee at the Brookings Institution charged with trying to reimagine the relationship between the federal government and states and localities, and the idea is to focus more on regions than localities. Explain the goal.
Well, it's the blueprint for American prosperity, and it's based on data that shows if we are going to compete globally, we need to focus our resources on the places that already are the economic engines that drive this country. And those are the metro areas. The problem is that in many metro areas, you have the dichotomy that you talked about at the top of the show. You have a split between city and suburbs, city interest and suburban interest. And they are encouraged by federal policies, by state legislatures. They are encouraged by the biases, some of the parochial interests of people on both sides of the city-county lines. And it's a really unhealthy thing for this country.
So since you're doing this with the think tank, the Brookings Institution, and looking at this as a national question, how has the Obama administration been in terms of understanding regional planning? They seem pretty focused on their urban agenda more than many recent presidents. How has their focus been on the suburbs and the potential for collaboration between the two, most importantly?
Well, the Obama administration, if you had the folks from their the White House Office of Urban Affairs would tell you, we're doing a great job. We get it, they would say. We understand that the suburbs have to be part of this equation. Because in most parts of the country, the suburbs are the economic engines that drive regions. That may not be a good thing either. because it means that the central cities have been in demise. In our area, New York City still is the engine. So the question is, if you want to sell this new paradigm, you've got to bring in the places that have the economic power, and that because of the changes in demographics have the political power. The problem with the Obama proposals is they really aren't working in the suburbs. There are all kinds of initiatives that require the kind of expertise, the kind of matching funds from private industry that most suburban communities, because they're small, because they're somewhat unsophisticated, and because they don't often get along with their bigger parents at the township and county level, just can't make. And so there's been a lot of frustration, and particularly in the minority suburban areas that desperately do need help, that are as poor as their central cities.
And that's still an unknown kind of secret to many people in America, because I know the Brookings Institution last month released some new stats on this that showed by 2008 the suburbs were home to the largest and fastest growing poor population in the country, and of course increasingly home to minority populations, as we talked about last week. Let's take a phone call from Kevin in East Setauket. Kevin, thanks a lot for calling. You're on WNYC.
Yes, good morning. How are you today?
I'm good. How you doing?
Okay. You know, I mean, I just, as somebody who lives in the suburbs, I look at the tax base as much greater in the city, and the schools get a lot more funding because of the police department that they have and security in there. We don't have that on the island. You know, we have nothing. We don't use the mass funding that you guys get. And then on top of that, I mean, on the island, we know that we don't get all of our tax, our school taxes back, because we have to fund, we have to help subsidize the city and the sub and upstate.
Now
that's not fair to us.
Now, Kevin, great call, because we could take just, you know, we could take half the board full of calls, Larry, with people calling from the city saying we're tired of subsidizing the rest of the state as the economic engine,
right,
which is true.
Well, there's truth on both sides of the city line. Long Islanders will point, often cherry-picking the stat that shows we send, I think it's 23% of the income taxes that are sent to Albany, and we only get, you know, 15% of the aid, and we have and then the city people will have a similar number. The reality is that that Long Islanders also spend more, and so it changes the percentages.
What do you mean by spend
well,
more?
Well, for example, if a school district gets $10,000 in state aid but decides to spend $25,000 a student, they're only getting 40% of their aid from New York. If they only spent $20,000 a student, which is a princely sum, they'd be getting 50%. In New York City, they're not spending anything like that, so the percentages that go to city students seem to be higher. A lot of these are spending decisions made at the local level on Long Island. By the same token, Long Island doesn't get the level of help for its big infrastructure projects that it needs to revive itself. We talked in past weeks about the need to rebuild downtowns, which requires unsexy things like sewers that are phenomenally expensive, well beyond the means of a suburban village to do. And for some reason, because the focus, primarily the focus politically of the Long Island delegation in Albany, has been school aid and to a lesser extent health care aid, other projects don't get the clout, and Long Island doesn't get the bucks.
Kevin, thank you for starting us off with this. And my guest is Larry Levy, who's been joining us every Thursday this month to talk about the suburbs in the New York area and city-suburb relations. He's a Long Island guy, by the way, longtime Newsday columnist,
right. As
many of you know, now with the Center for Suburban Studies at Hofstra University, and Ari in Rockland. If Kevin feels that competition, I think Ari in Rockland does not. Hi, Ari. Thanks for calling. Turn your radio off. We could just listen to the last 10 seconds of our show again. They were so good. Let's try Yona in Port Washington while Ari gets his radio together. Hi, Yona.
Good morning. I want to comment that the problems of the city are now the problems of the suburb. In other words, here in Long Island, and in many places in the country, you have the global economy, open borders. This was a middle-class community of plumbers and carpenters and all that, and now mostly unionized middle class. Now they have to compete with many people who have the same skills on the street who will do it for much less. The schools in some parts of Long Island resemble the schools in New York City. Mm-hmm. Dropouts, people who have a lot of illegal immigration, and it's happening everywhere. I have a brother who lives in Colorado. Colorado has a lot of young, skilled professionals outweighed by a lot of poor people.
Yonah, thank you very much. So is there more, politically speaking, Larry, of a competition now, more of a divide between, let's say, city and inner suburbs, and then more of outer suburbs or exurbs? I think it's really the exurbs where we see the Tea Party movement springing up, for example, and other kinds of alienation from, you know, from the dense metropolitan areas. Would you say that that's the right way to look at it?
In many parts of the country, it is. In our part of the country, not quite, because of the political jurisdictions. The Long Island delegation, the senators and assembly people, for example, tend to vote the same way. The Suffolk delegation may go off on a couple of areas where the Nassau people don't care all that much about. But by and large, they tend to, Republicans and Democrats alike, by the way, tend to represent their constituents, as a block. And this is a response to political decisions, political traditions in negotiations that tend to treat Long Island as a block, upstate as a block, and New York City as a block. And where it used to be in school aid, for example, it was assumed Long Island would get X percent, and that couldn't change no matter what was going on in Long Island relative to New York City. If New York City schools were falling off a cliff, which they were for many years, New York City would still get the same percentage. And then the game was, how do you divide it up among the regions?
Right.
This was a counterproductive way of making policy, and it led not only to New York City struggling for many years more than it had to, but it led to the creation of these pockets of poverty on Long Island, which, as the other caller said, are just as bad off as a lot of neighborhoods in New York City.
From our website, Liz, she writes in as Liz from Suburbia and says, you're not thought of as a true New Yorker if you're not from any of the boroughs. I lived in New York all my life, but I don't get any of the respect as being a New Yorker that others get. Nathan from Hoboken, I think we have a pretty large-scale failure of regional planning across New York City, New Jersey examples. Taxi cabs, it takes extortion to get a cab to Hoboken, 2 miles away, but the law that the cab has to take you 10 miles away into Queens is unfair. Another example was that stadium on the west side with all the noise and planning that was nothing about fixing the tunnels or trains from New Jersey, where many people would attend events would come from. Northern New Jersey has enough transit and traffic problems. The stadium would have made it worse. There's a long list of issues that are just ignored in New Jersey, New York City planning. Larry.
Well, this is a question more of leadership than of government forms. We have the Port Authority, which should unite, for example, New Jersey, the state and the suburbs, with New York. It should bring or enable more of a regional approach to solving problems. We have NMTEC, which is a little-known organization that acts as a planning and clearinghouse for the expenditure of federal funds in the region. And there is membership of suburban officials and city officials as well. But it always seems to break down on the leadership level. It breaks down around election time when suburban people decide they're going to campaign against the city and city people decide they're going to campaign against the suburbs. And in the end, it becomes harder and harder when you campaign like that to govern as one region.
You use the example, I think, in your Brookings Institution work of Denver as a positive example. They built a light rail system fueled by a robust council of suburban and central Denver officials.
Right. And in fact, they're proud of saying that they got very, very little federal funds there. They did it themselves. They created a council where the mayor of Denver, he may be the mayor of the biggest municipality there, but the mayor of Denver had one vote. It wasn't, you know, in the sense that they voted 6-7 that now you're going to do a certain thing. But he had one voice in the room, and he respected the mayor of Centennial and the mayor of where Coors is out in Boulder.
I'm not sure exactly where they are.
Yeah, it's west of Denver.
Let's go to Marjorie in Hackensack. Marjorie, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi.
Now, wait a minute. Is Hackensack a suburb or is Hackensack a city?
City.
I'd call it a city.
But we're close. We're about 5 miles from the GW Bridge,
yeah.
So we're really close. I'm an artist, and I feel that New York, it's fabulous in terms of my personal visits to the museums and all that sort of thing. But in terms of the competition that New York offers, it's really tough because we have lots of marvelous artists here, and we have lots of shows, but the visitors to the shows are usually other artists and the friends and family of
right.
artists.
Right, so it's like Liz from Suburbia wrote on our page, you're not thought of as a true New Yorker, you don't get that respect if you don't actually live in the boroughs.
Well, it isn't so much not getting the respect, but most people feel that if they want to see, New York has so much to offer, you know, in terms of the great art and all mm-hmm. that sort of thing, that they would rather spend their time there. I mean, they respect us, but in terms of buying art, they go to New York to buy. We don't sell very much here. And in terms of funding, do you know the local museum was asked to leave their headquarters because they didn't they couldn't get the financial support?
Which museum is that?
The Bergen Museum.
Oh.
So right now it's in limbo.
Marjorie, thank you very much. Michelle in Harlem, you're on WNYC. Hi, Michelle, real quick, because we're running out of time.
Oh, yeah, sure. Hi, guys. I'm sorry to keep this divide going between the city and the suburbs, but I'm definitely a native New Yorker, born and raised in Brooklyn, and I think, you know, you have to be, you have to spend time in New York and make your bones here before you can call yourself a New Yorker. Sorry, suburbanites, but I've made my bones, so I'm definitely a New Yorker, and I think you have to have that in order to claim being a New Yorker.
Thank you, but then we better give Ari in Rockland the last word. Hi, Ari.
Ari, I'll make it quick. Maybe we should change the call letters from WNYC to WNYS to represent we shouldn't feel alienated. But on a side note. But I, as living in Rockland...
NYSNJCT, but go ahead.
Okay, I think that those folks living further upstate, they feel more aggravated. I think just yesterday they had a story on Morning Edition about the prison where to count for the Census Bureau. But I think that Rockland, I feel fair represented over here.
And you don't feel competitive with the city. You think they get their fair share of funds and things like that. So, Larry Levy, we're just about to wrap up this series. This has been really great. We've had such a wonderful response from people in the city and all around the suburbs to the fact that we've had this kind of dialogue going for 4 weeks, and you've done such a great job. And mm-hmm. You know, I know that part of your reporting at Newsday over the years was really on this city-suburban divide, as well as just looking at Long Island politics, as you did for a long time. And now with the National Center on Suburban Studies at Hofstra University. So what do you hope to accomplish going forward? Just give us 30 seconds.
Well, I hope that in shows like this help that we can begin to bridge this divide, both politically, socially, and economically. Because even if you don't buy into the kumbaya of it, that it's great to get people together, it's in our best economic interests. Same deal with losing this myth of wealth and wellness about the suburbs and realizing that it has some incredible problems that it needs the region's, you know, might and expertise to help solve. And I hope that we can accomplish that.
Larry, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Up next, we have James Fallows from The Atlantic. We'll listen to a couple of clips from the Obama Healthcare Summit that is underway and talk about that, plus cyber warfare. He is very concerned, is James Fallows, about cyber warfare and China. He says China is not going to be a conventional military threat to the United States anytime soon, no matter what anybody fears. Cyber warfare, different story. So we'll talk to James Fallows about that and the healthcare summit underway coming up. Stay with us.